I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
Play ball! It's 30 with Murdy, with your host, Sweeney Murdy.
Hi, welcome back, everybody. On this episode of 30 with Murdy, we take a look back at a landmark baseball film, one of the best documentaries ever about the sport because of how unique the footage was. It's hard to find new images of the best known and most photographed stars in the game's history, like Mickey Mantle and Babe Ruth, but when George Roy and his partner Steve Stern stumbled onto a collection of home movies that featured moving full-color images of Mantle, Ruth, Jackie Robinson, Ted Williams, Lou Gehrig, and dozens of others from a golden era in baseball history, well, they knew they had found something special. 30 years ago this summer, they turned that home movie treasure chest into the HBO film When It Was a Game. And it was amazing to see color images of players we mostly knew in black and white jump off the screen, showing small glimpses of their personalities outside the game. When It Was a Game was culled from home movies taken between 1934 and 1957 with all their original color, and weaved together with player interviews and old poems to paint a picture of a simpler time in American sports, the film hit all the right notes and eventually led to a pair of sequels when even more original footage was discovered. George Roy was the executive producer of the film, his first after a career that began on the iconic baseball highlight show This Week in Baseball. For a look back at the 30th anniversary of When It Was a Game, here is my conversation with George Roy. George, the first thing I want to ask you is, what was it like for you to watch it again 30 years later? You put so much time and energy into making it, had kind of disappeared off your landscape for a while. So when you watched it again, what do you think?
It was a lot of fun. I mean, I really enjoyed it. I hadn't seen it probably from beginning to end in at least 20 years. Part of that has to do with the fact that, as we laughed about, it's hard to find a DVD player nowadays. Yeah. And I poked around a little bit to see if I could find it on demand somewhere. And I think they do cycle it through HBO from time to time, but it just wasn't part of their schedule at this point. But I loved it. And I think one of the things I really took away from it was when we did it originally in 91, our intention was to sort of create a timeless piece that would be just as relevant when you watched it years and years and years later, because it just essentially didn't change. And it kind of affirmed the thought that we had back then, because when I watched it, it hadn't changed at all, which was sort of part of its charm. So I think when we sat out to do it, which was sort of not unlike creating like a scrapbook in essence. So when you open up a scrapbook 30 years later, the images still seem to be the same. So I think from that perspective, it was really interesting.
I think one of the things that I enjoyed is that I remember watching it at the time and seeing like the living history just pouring right out of it. But if you think back to the context of it, when it's out in 1991, you still have 26 teams in each league. There hasn't been a strike that's canceled a World Series yet. The highest paid free agents are only making $3 to $4 million a year. It seems quaint now, but this idea of, oh, look how far away we've been, you know, it's 30 years later, it feels even farther in that regard to me.
Yeah, no, it does. It does. And just when you think that things can't end or get even more extreme, you know, you look at values of teams, you know, when someone buys a team for, you know, $300 million in 1995, you say to yourself, how is that possible? And then 10 years later, it's worth 10X. And same with salaries, and same with how far we've come from all the elements that we did point out, and how the game was different back then and seemingly more romantic and slower, and fans were connected to it a bit more. But it is kind of interesting how, you know, and I guess not unlike the value of homes too, you just think that, all right, well, it's never going to get higher than this. And yet somehow it does. And that's sort of what happens. And it sort of makes those times almost like fine wine, you know, it makes those times stand out even more, you know?
There was one specific element of that I'm going to come back to later on, but I'm curious as you put this together, how did this begin? Do you remember the first time you saw one of these home movies? What was the process of getting them in your hands? How did you come into contact with all of these home movies that became When It Was a Game?
Yeah. Well, it has an interesting story and a history like all these things usually do. My partner and I, Steve Stern, were both at Major League Baseball Productions for at least 5 years. I got there in 83. He was there a year before me. And I had produced This Week in Baseball with Mel Allen and worked with so many great people when I was there. It was such a great place to have your first job in the industry that you love. Steve and I got to the point in 1988 where we had become very friendly personally and professionally. And it had come time to sort of move on and see what the next chapter was. So we left Major League Baseball Productions, and much to our surprise, the Los Angeles Dodgers, whom we had had a working relationship with, said yes when we asked them if we could do their highlight film. And this was 1988, and it was just him and I and in a little office somewhere on the West Side with really no work at the time, but just, you know, a desire to sort of do some things on our own. And the Dodgers, shocked us and said yes, you know. So we did the Los Angeles Dodger highlight film by ourselves in like a phone booth back then. And everyone who knows baseball knows what happened that year. So Gibson hit the home run and it became like a thing. I mean, there was, you know, we laughed about DVDs, but they had VHSs obviously back then. And it was a hot item. It went kind of viral, I guess, let's say, in Los Angeles, because it was an amazing season and it was an amazing ending to the season. 2 years later, the Dodgers had their 100th anniversary. And at that point, we had had a really good relationship with them based on that film. And they asked us if we wanted to do a history film. And we said, sure. And so we somehow serendipitously had connected to this gentleman in Brooklyn. His name was Meyer Robinson, and he actually owned the Manischewitz Wine Company. Hmm. And this is sort of how the genesis of When It Was a Game ironically started. Meyer had told us that he had a movie camera and that he had great seats because he would have the Dodgers over after all the games to sample his wine and to have a big, huge dinner once a week. So he'd have Pee Wee there and Duke and Jackie and all the guys there. And, we went to his home and he brought out a huge big box of color film. At that time, they were the, you know, from Rochester, New York, they were the yellow boxes, you know, yeah. Everyone in their mind's eye can imagine what they were. And he put them in an old 16 millimeter projector and played it for us. And we at the time had been at baseball for 5 or 6 years and we knew every inch of footage that existed, every, you know, archival element of baseball ever. That point, I had never seen anything like this stuff. We were completely blown away. And we were young enough so that we had actually never had been in Ebbets Field as kids to see this. But in my mind, I'm thinking, geez, how would a 50-year-old person who probably had never seen or imagined seeing Duke Snider in color again, you know, they had seen him as a kid, but ever since then, they had seen him in black and white and newsreels and all the stuff that Major League Baseball had thrown out. So we knew that there was a magical element there. So we took it to HBO at the time, and Ross Greenberg and Seth Abraham was there at the time. Seth was a huge Brooklyn Dodger fan. And it was just like a warm knife through butter. We showed them the stuff in an office one day, and we all just were kind of levitating, like off the couch. We knew that there was something there. And they were really, really magnanimous about giving us the time and giving us a little money to try to find more of this stuff. Because in my mind, and in Steve's mind, we thought, well, if there was a Meyer Robinson in Brooklyn, there's got to be one in Cincinnati. There's got to be one in Boston. There's got to be one in Philly. And then when, before we knew it, we realized that Bell and Howell at the point at that time had been giving Major League Baseball players as premiums and for appearing on radio shows and for doing stuff for and with their, you know, their various sponsors. They had given them these movie cameras who were relatively new at the time. So the players had cameras. Wow. And would use them and would shoot kids' birthdays and Thanksgivings and Halloweens and so forth. And then there'd be 10 minutes of spring training on there. And like somehow all these things came together, and it was a little bit daunting at first because we didn't have the advantages that we have now with the internet and searching for people and looking for people. So after about 9 or 10 months, we ended up finding like 60 or 70 hours of the color footage from all over the country, their various teams, players, people associated with the teams. And then we knew we kind of had something. And then we made a whole series of choices as to how to put it together. And we're pretty happy with the way it came out.
That's a really interesting nugget about the cameras given to players. Because one of the questions I was going to ask you is if you knew what the history was with, you know, the consumer end of the 8mm and 16mm cameras, because, you know, this isn't, you're talking about footage that was shot in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. This isn't like everybody walking around with an iPhone. Right. And players, I guess, at that time would do anything to supplement their income because right. It was, you know, they were not being paid huge salaries. So when they were being given free items from sponsors, I mean, they would gladly use them. And so that answers a really important question here. That's a very small detail in the business of baseball back then. But without it, you don't have a show.
No, you're exactly right. Without that, and also without the fact that the players all acted so uninhibitedly, you know, it's not like someone from the media nowadays trying to capture a nuanced moment or trying to capture an innocent moment. They were just their teammates. And so the imagery and the sense that these players give when they're fooling around or at their, you know, when they let their hair down a little bit, they're actually not letting their hair down. They're just acting natural because that's the way they act in front of their teammates. So we had the best of both worlds when it came to capturing them in a moment in time, which was clearly unique because they never would have acted like that in front of either strangers or someone from the supposed media, you know?
It's like, you know, it's the last century's Instagram is probably what it is. It's guys just having fun on their own without having a big crowd around them. And that's kind of one of my favorite parts about this is, you know, it's the non-game action that you captured. It's the people with their families or with their teammates or just at practice throwing a ball around. They're waving to the fans who are holding the cameras in the stands. You can't get that now. There are 20,000 people in the seats every night holding out phones and trying to get their videos of people. The players aren't interacting with them yet. Here you have Jackie Robinson walking up to the man behind the dugout and just waving to him in full color. I've seen black and white pictures of Jackie Robinson and Lou Gehrig. I've never seen them in full color. And, you know, as many times as you saw it from the time that you first got these films in your hands to just watching the show again, you know, a couple of days before we talked, how does that image strike you that you're seeing people that you only knew as black and white still pictures and you're seeing them in live action full color?
Yeah, no, and it was pretty amazing seeing it for the first time. And we would be like, it would be like Christmas morning, probably 75 times a year, because we would somehow have to figure out how to get the material from people. And it was either UPS ground or something and the film would arrive in our office in these huge big boxes. And we would just sit down and be so excited to watch them for the first time with the group of us. It was me and Steve and Eric Paulin and George Amir, who were the primary forces for us over the course of the year getting the stuff. And, you know, it is interesting that you say that about the cameras, because I've often thought of that too. And guys like Jackie Robinson and Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams stopping and acknowledging someone, whether it was their teammate or someone in the first row with a camera.
Yeah.
And I think because these cameras were so unique and so special, it was almost like a glorified stop sign or something. It was almost like they were so important. If someone had took the time to aim the thing at you, you were going to stop and oblige them or tip your hat or do something. Whereas nowadays there's so many of them that they just become like wallpaper. Like none of them are important. But if there's two or three people among 25,000 people, including one of your teammates that has this device, you know, you're thinking to myself, oh, geez, he's taking the time to aim it at me. I got to do something, you know? And so that was sort of interesting to sort of get a sense of that sort of less is more component of how these things and how these images actually happen.
And there isn't footage of these guys playing, but just being older men walking onto a field in live action, seeing Ty Cobb and Cy Young. Again, you know, I mean, I don't think you or I know anybody that saw these people walking around in real life. So to have those images, that must have been something that you know, hit you a different way too when you saw it.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/decide. That's linkedin.com/decide. Terms and conditions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
We were completely blown away when we saw Ty Cobb and Cy Young and even an older Babe Ruth in color. I mean, it was just, a complete game changer. We were just like stunned, and how are we going to figure out how not to screw this up? You know, we have to put a show together that people are going to enjoy, and how do we do it and how do we execute it? Do we just put the stuff out there and just sort of let it roll and take advantage of the fact that the footage itself is so great, or do we somehow figure out how to kind of combine it with music and poetry and readings? And that's sort of the route that we did go to try to complement it one way or the other without really kind of, I don't want to say ruining it, but without sort of, you know, overproducing it, you know. So it was a little bit of a balancing act there at first. And, you know, I think at that time or shortly thereafter, you know, Ken Burns had done his baseball piece for PBS, you know, which is obviously great, you know, but we looked at sort of our shows as sort of the, like a golf schedule, like we're doing the Masters, you know, we're doing the U.S. Open. We'll let him do the, you know, the Northwestern. We'll let him do, I don't want to say quantity over quality, because he did a great, but it wasn't going to be comprehensive. It was, we were going to do a show that was going to appeal emotionally to people who, at 12 or 13 years old, you know, walked into Yankee Stadium or Fenway Park or Wrigley Field and have not had that moment since, where they're seeing these people in color.
Well, and you found the right demo, because if you're talking about in 1991, you know, the last 10 years have been this real explosion in nostalgia and collectibles around baseball. The baseball card market boomed. All the autographed memorabilia and stuff boomed. The Mickey Mantle stuff took off basically from the early 80s into the early 90s. So this is the time period where you're tugging at the heartstrings of the baby boomers who now have money to spend and look back fondly on their youth. I mean, you hit the exact right audience when you found this stuff.
Yeah, no, we were a little surprised by that too. You know, we were all baseball fans, grew up a generation or so afterwards. You know, we came to love the game, you know, in the 70s. So it was a little bit different, but we understood the connections as kids that we had to players, because baseball always changes, you know. And in my mind, there was, you know, nobody like, you know, Roberto Clemente, or nobody could catch like Johnny Bench, or no one could, like, you just had players in your mind that you just connected to so significantly because it was such a big part of your life. You know, you'd be in the back playing wiffle ball and you'd co-op, you know, you'd go through the lineup and you were a certain guy and had all the batting stances. And we were those types of kids and people, Steve and myself. So we just assumed and knew from reading all the baseball books and how important baseball history was that that was going to be a pretty easy audience to tap into once they got a chance to see this stuff for the first time, because it was really like ethereal. I mean, it was really like literally when you think about it, these guys had not seen these. The only place you could see players was at the stadium. I mean, there was no, there was no digital component. There was no television. So, you know, you'd read about them and you'd argue about the players with your friends and so forth. And then the four or five times a year, you had the opportunity to go to a game, which in some cases was a lot. You cherished that experience and that stuck with you. And it was almost like it had not been opened again until they saw these clips.
The, you know, there's a, you know, Billy Crystal says it in City Slickers, which also came out in 1991, but he talks about, you know, walking out in the Yankee Stadium and seeing the green grass and the copper roof because you only had a black and white television. So again, seeing the stuff in color is something different. There's a couple of things that I remember picking out of this, watching it again, that really illustrate to you how different a time it was. One was that the Cubs and Red Sox are still considered cursed franchises because they haven't won anything yet. And we know that that's taken, it took to the turn of the century to get it done, but we know that changed. But I also find interesting, you have footage, you found the oldest existing color footage of a World Series game, which was 1938, Cubs-Yankees, but the Cubs had a parade before the World Series. There's this great footage of, you know, Letterman-style Cubs jackets walking through and into Wrigley Field, and the voiceover just says, it's a parade they had before the World Series. Who has a parade before the World Series, George?
Well, I think one of two things. They either had a premonition that it was going to be a short series and they were going to lose in four. They were going to lose in four straight, which they did. Maybe they were celebrating the fact that they had made it to just to play the Yankees. They knew ultimately what the outcome was going to be. Or it was just a celebration on one of these big seminal baseball cities that pointed to the significance of the game itself, you know, baseball itself, and what it meant to the people in Chicago to have followed this team for so long and for them to get to this point. To them, it was important. You know, there were not too many other big major distractions going on in the way of sports or entertainment or whatever. And the Cubs to the people in Chicago were really special, you know, and I felt when you watch those images and see the ticker tapes, you know, all the stuff from that, you would think that they were at the Canyon of Heroes and they were celebrating a dramatic 7-game win. But in fact, you're right, the series had not even started yet. But it was interesting to see that. But I think it's sort of the 30,000 foot view on that, I think, is that baseball held such a special place in fans' hearts and minds at that point. That's different.
And I mean, and this is before interleague play. You won your league. You won something. It meant something. So celebrating that too. One of the other things that stood out, listen, the color footage of Yankee pinstripes doesn't really change the view very much, right? I mean, those uniforms pretty much play out in color or black and white. But one of the things I noticed was, yeah, in some of the Joe DiMaggio footage, I'm watching the players behind him, and there's a number 7 standing in the background, and it's not Mickey Mantle. And it takes you a second to remember that, you know, all these numbers that have been retired for decades now, that somebody else wore them. You see Joe D and saying, this is like the late 30s or early 40s. That's not Mantle wearing some. That might be Tommy Henrik or somebody else. And it takes you a second to process that when you're watching it.
Yeah. No, it is. We joke about the fact that I was at the Yankee Red Sox game last week with my nephew, and he was saying, like, at some point the Yankees are going to run out of numbers, you know, because they retired so many of them. But back then it was different. And I think the 38 team, it was Jake Powell. It's interesting because if you Google him, he's got a whole another story, which is pretty fascinating and fairly sordid, actually. There was my mind is a bit mushy these days, but they had given Mickey's number to another player after Mickey retired, like in the early 50s, until they at some point decided, all right, well, we've got to retire these numbers.
Well, it's funny. You know, there's a large portion of this show that's devoted to the World War II and the patriotism around World War II. One of the things that I find kind of, you know, I just happened to glance at it last night for a different reason, but the Yankees let another player named Nick Etten wear number 5 while Joe DiMaggio went to war. Joe DiMaggio's in World War II, you know, in the military service, and there's another, you know, baseball is still going. I mean, I thought about this a few years ago. I'm thinking, wouldn't it be funny, like, if Derek Jeter went to Iraq and somebody else wore number 2 while he was, I mean, it's sad because we attach so much to the player and their uniform and their number these days. I don't know that it meant anything to them back then because they, I mean, think about it, 1942, Joe DiMaggio's already become Jolton Joe, and they just gave his number to somebody else. I guess they couldn't afford the other numbers back then.
They had the MVP the year before. Yeah, who knows? I mean, it was all hands on deck at that point. Who knows? There might have been a new equipment manager. There might have been someone who had come along and, you know, there was just a case of uniforms there, and somebody just threw it to someone and didn't look or didn't care. But, you know, so many things have changed back then. I know that the players at that point probably could care less. You know, it's just a matter of, you know, trying to sort of, you know, brand the team and attach import to these numbers was something that was a sort of a fairly modern thing when you think about baseball history. You know, I mean, modern meaning 60 or 70 years,
right.
You know.
I'm kind of curious now. I got to look up and see if Nick Etten was roughly the same build as DiMaggio, and maybe that's the reason he's given him the actual shirt. But it's funny, though. Like, that leads me into something else, what you just talked about. There's a quote in there from Eldon Auker, who was a really good, you know, fountain of information and anecdotes for you during the course of this. And he said, you know, he was talking about the idea of, like, you know, this is before free agency, well before free agency. And you were a property of that team. And he said, you were just like an automobile. They could get rid of you and get a new one at any time. And we've come so far in the labor relations part of baseball and the business part of baseball that we kind of forget what this used to be. And that the title kind of brings me back to something else that maybe isn't as much fun. When you say when it was a game, the players kind of treated it that way, but the owners didn't. The owners, you know, had their iron fist ways and their tight fisted ways for decades. But what I kind of took, George, is from the players of that era didn't really seem to get all that bent out of shape about it. They felt it was a game. And as years went by, you know, I think they understood, but at that particular point in time, it didn't seem like they cared that, you know, their livelihood was being shaped in a much different manner than what could have been if they had proper representation.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because that was one of the takeaways from watching it again all these years later. And we did discuss it back then that there was a real balance between the way we approached the show, and there was a real balance between the romantic element of playing and participating in a game and the reality of it. You're right. I mean, the players were under the thumbs of the owners in all respects, every part of the game. And when a guy like Enos Slaughter talks about going to spring training after hitting 320 for 5 straight years and driving in 100 runs and literally felt like he was tooth and nail, had to scrape and claw in order to make the team. So I think the connection that the fans had with the players of that era was partly a result of that commitment that these guys made to the game and made to the craft and made to every single game, running out to the outfield or running balls out or just getting it. Just the game seemed to kind of roll out differently because of the realities and because of the desperation that some of these guys would have without having guaranteed contracts and guaranteed money. And, you know, it just connected, I think, the fans to the players as well. And the players were happy being Major League Baseball players because no one else from their neighborhood or no one else that they knew in their family was making $800 a month.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, if you were working at a store, working at in construction or putting together, you know, doing a regular job back then, you were making a third of that, you know, so everything's relative. So it was an honor to be a Major League Baseball player and make that kind of money and play the game you loved, despite the fact that you were probably being taken advantage of at every turn. I mean, there was Enos Florida tells a story about them traveling, and they had, obviously, before the mid-50s, they would travel everywhere on the train. Mm-hmm. You know, and they weren't going out to California quite yet. That would come years later. But they would travel from, you know, St. Louis after a doubleheader and go to Philadelphia or whatever, a 17, 18-hour train ride. And they would stop halfway, the train would pull over, and they would play an exhibition game, like at 2 in the afternoon. So the owner of the team could put $250 in his pocket. Yeah. You know, they would do those sorts of things. You know, it was just the reality of working for an owner. It was no different from any other industry, except these guys were playing the game they loved. And I think, you know, in their minds, you know, most of them probably would have played for free. So, you know, there wasn't really a thought, you know, until later on, obviously, and rightly so, in the mid to late 60s with Curt Flood and the like, things sort of began to change. But up until that point, they were fine with that trade off.
The show holds up really well, mostly because I think we all still have some affinity for baseball history. One of the other things that really just makes it stand out is the score. The music score in this show was really fantastic, George.
Yeah, no, it was Ferdinand J. Smith is the composer's name, and I've kind of lost touch with him. I should probably circle back and see what he's up to. But it was, you know, Ross Greenberg and I and Steve, we kind of helped him as best we could in regards to sort of generally what sort of score we thought it would have. I remember kind of like a John Williams sort of thing going back and forth, and we had a couple other cues that we sent his way. But when we heard that, particularly the first four or five bars, we were like, that's it, you know, that's it. And then that was so fun about watching the show again, you know, it was just, it starts with that and you just immediately just get drawn in, and you're immediately, it's like a time capsule. And the score, you're right, that's a very astute observation, because the score really, really ties it together. And I can't even imagine what the show would be without the score, you know. And the music, from where I sit, you know, you spend months doing something and you're like a kid waiting for the score, waiting for the music to kind of come together, because the narrative and everything about the show takes on a whole different and goes to a whole different level if the score is really good. And that's what it did. And I'll be forever grateful for how they came up with that and how it's really stood up, because it really is among the more timeless elements of the show. I mean, it really does stand up pretty well.
I think, you know, the original show and its two sequels both have a lot of wonderful footage that just people haven't seen before. It wasn't like you're compiling stock footage or just compiling things that have been in different places. You are getting material that nobody's ever seen of people that you know very well and have seen. And if people can find them, I mean, you and I, you know, ran through fire drills just to get a DVD back and forth to each other. There are parts of it that exist on YouTube and other places. But if people get a chance to watch this when it was a game, if you are a baseball fan of any kind, it certainly is worth finding. I want to ask you about, you know, you mentioned something earlier when we were talking about where your career began on This Week in Baseball. And that's it's kind of been brought back in different ways. And MLB Network has a show that they use some of the Mel Allen clips. But it's a much different world now. And I want to know if you can put into some sort of context, because you worked on the show, how groundbreaking it was to gather a 30-minute show once a week that featured highlights of pretty much all the teams from around the league and highlighted the best and funniest and craziest plays of an entire week for 30 minutes on a Saturday or a Sunday. You know, now I can find everything seconds after it happens on social media if I didn't see it myself on one of the, you know, seven games that are on my TV every night, or if I get the package, you know, you get them all. you were working at a time when it was hard to get that, and it was a novel idea to gather footage from every major league team and package it together in one 30-minute show when the games you're showing are already a week or 10 days old. But it was groundbreaking at the time. What was that like working on it?
Well, first of all, let me say it was definitely the coolest place I've ever worked at. And I'm grateful that I was lucky enough to have started my career there, because, as you know, it's so important where you start and who you meet and sort of where you go from there. And when I got there, there had already been so many great people there who went on to do so many great things. And then when I got a chance to, shortly after I got there, to kind of move up into the producer's rank, I had the opportunity to work with great people like Bob Bodsner and Joe Levine and Sean Mooney and Chris Chambers and all these people that went on to do great things both there and thereafter. And you learn so much so quickly because you did everything. It's not like today when you come up and you're a writer, so you're not going to go out in the field and produce. You're an editor, so you're not going to produce necessarily. We did everything. They just threw us in and said, go. And so we would go to spring training with a group of us, and we would have the time of our lives, and we'd be talking to all these players. And it was just so much fun. That was my macro takeaway. As far as doing the show goes, it was challenging because of how and to what degree it takes a Seattle Mariner game that was played on 10:30 at night in Seattle. I mean, we're relying on those 4 3/4-inch videotapes somehow to get to New York.
Right.
You know, after the game ends on, it's not like, you know, you can just send a file or download something or upload something. So that was challenging. And we'd often have to kind of plot the show around when we'd actually get the footage, you know? And so we would watch the keep in touch with baseball as best we could throughout the weekend, and then come in on Monday and have the Bob Bodsner, who was the lead producer on the show. I was so lucky to work with him for 3 years. Him and I would create, you know, a plot for the show. And at that point, there had been a series of the younger guys that had been there. We all started off as viewers, you know, so you'd sit in a big row and just view games and look for bloopers and great plays. And we had sheets where we would pick out all the highlights and things like that. And everything was all on paper, and it was all 3/4-inch videotape. And we would just somehow, by hook or crook, we would throw it together and work long hours, and like we all do nowadays. And it was just, you know, it would come together after a while, and you'd work with people who were really committed and passionate about trying to do the best show you possibly could. And it could get challenging, but it was fun at the same time. And often it would come down to the last hour or two. But you know, it often, like I said earlier, it would depend upon, you know, how quickly we were able to get games, because, you know, when you think of the mid 80s, if the Mariners played, let's say, the Royals on 10:30 on Monday, there's a chance that you couldn't get that tape until Thursday.
Yeah.
You know, so it was challenging from that perspective, but it was just heaven. I mean, Mel, to be working with Mel Allen every week and to, you know, just be in the trenches with these guys and women and just getting it done. It was the most fun I've ever had. And it also, it was the most I've ever learned, because you're kind of just learning under fire. You're learning on the fly. And after 2, 3, 4 years of doing that, you come away thinking, geez, I can kind of do anything now, you know? And that was really the case.
I'll give you another example. I mean, late 80s, early 90s is this Bo Jackson highlight, when he throws out Harold Reynolds at home plate. That's Mariners Royals at 10 o'clock at night, like you're talking about. Yeah. And if a play like that happened today, we would all see it 5 seconds after it happened. And I don't know how long it took to see that play, but I know that, you know, the majority of people who saw it didn't see it when it happened or even the night it happened. Most of the people saw it probably days after it happened. I guess, you know, SportsCenter was around, so you could have, you know, that was a little bit of a game changer too. But the immediacy of things, I mean, there was still a place for a show that would just compile things and bring them to a nice little package, that because you didn't have time to watch everything all over the place. And
This Week in Baseball was very special to a lot of people, and it was special because of that component. You know, it would be the one place where you'd be able to see, you know, the Padres or that series. You'd get to see some of these different teams that maybe you were a fan of, or you had some interest in it because your dad grew up there, or you had some sort of connection to a team outside your market. And you're right. I mean, SportsCenter did come along, but then, you know, there were a lot of people that didn't have cable TV.
Sure.
So, you know, that 1 or 1:30, that syndicated television market would tune in right before their home game on a Saturday or Sunday. And This Week in Baseball will be on before the Yankee game or the Met game. And I never forget living in the George Washington Hotel on 23rd between Park and Lexington. And that's where I lived for 2 years. And I would get up on Sunday purposely. I did this purposely. And I'd walk down the hall and I'd hear the show in some of the rooms. Like, there'd be a couple old timers in there, and they would watch the show regularly. And I would just walk down the hall, just listening to the, again, we talk about themes and music. I mean, when it was a game and This Week in Baseball, pretty iconic themes, both of them, you know, the Gathering Crowds was the name of that music. And it just sticks to you now, you know, it was something special about, you know, that moment in time. And obviously everything changes, and there was really no need for a weekly baseball highlight show, but it did become part of people's lives in a real significant way.
I can tell you, listen, as a kid growing up in Pennsylvania, if I wanted to see Rod Carew, for example, I saw him in the All-Star game and I saw him on This Week in Baseball, and that was it. There were no other periods in my life when I could watch him play during the course of that time. You've worked on so many great projects, and HBO has been a partner of yours for a long time. And you and I have talked over the years as some of these have happened. I mean, there's a Mickey Mantle doc that people have probably seen that you did. I'm going to forget some or maybe mix some up, but Dean Smith, Miracle on Ice. I think the 72 Olympic basketball team, that was yours too. You have a dream project that you're still trying to think of that maybe you want to work on that is kind of in the wings here?
Nothing in the wings as far as dream projects go. I was always a huge fan of Roberto Clemente when I was a kid, and I always wanted to do a full-length documentary on him. There's been a couple that have been done, and they've actually been quite good, so I don't know, maybe the window's shut on that. I was always and still am infatuated by Satchel Paige. I mean, I think he's got a really great story when you can weave in the history of the Negro Leagues and the character that he was and the ability and the charisma that he had. I mean, here was a guy who pitched in the major leagues when he was 65 years old, you know, for the Oakland A's against the Red Sox. And there's just so much that you could work in there that is above and beyond baseball, you know. The problem with that is that, you know, you'd have to have a big budget. You'd have to recreate a lot of things. There's not a lot of footage.
Sure.
But the books and the stories and the legend of Satchel Paige would be a fun project, and also be, I think, a really educational and worthwhile project to do. Who would do it? Who knows when I might be able to find the time to do it or try to get someone interested in doing it. I just heard this week that Spike Lee is going to be doing a project, I think, with Netflix on the Negro League. So I'm not sure if I'm supposed to talk about that or not.
That's all right.
We'll all find out, I guess, at some point. And so maybe they'll do some. I'm sure that he'll be a huge part of that. Beyond that, I don't, you know, I pick up things from time to time and look. I just read a couple of weeks ago where the Pirates had honored the 1971 Pittsburgh Pirate team, which I thought for the last 25 years would be a great documentary. Same with the 71 All-Star game. There's these, you know, that interesting period of time where baseball had sort of not gotten over the hump, but there was a recognition, and maybe they hadn't even realized it at the time, but the 71 Pirates being so integrated. And it was the first time an all African-American Latin team had, you know, 1-9, and then a bunch of pitchers, and then just the irony and the shame of the fact that, you know, we're now, Jesus, how many years? 50 years
50
later?
50 years, yeah.
Yeah, 50 years later, and baseball, you know, by hook or crook, I don't know whose fault this is ultimately, but you know, the trend at that point and the possibilities of going forward with those sorts of teams and the complexion of those sorts of teams really kind of fell by the wayside. And those big macro elements like that, that speak to things beyond and so much more significant to baseball, are so important to have in these shows. And you'd use a team like the 71 Pirates, who obviously were led by Clemente and Stargell, but, you know, I think of Dave Cash and Rennie Stennett and all the pieces, you know, Manny Sanguin, and the way that that team looked and carried themselves and, you know, how cool they were. And then to have in 2021, you don't even really even have a sense of any of whatever that possibility was, you know, and it's kind of, that to me would be an interesting, and again, I think it's been done like in maybe in print, and there's not a lot of the guys left anymore. Some of them have died, you know, at a young age. And there's always something that, you know, pops along that piques your interest, but, you know, I'm getting old now at this point. So if I don't do them all, you know, that's fine with me. I'll get the golf clubs and the fishing rod out and I'll be happy, you know.
My thanks again to George Roy, executive producer for When It Was a Game. The film is kind of hard to find because it's not currently on HBO streaming platforms, but if you are able to find it, it's worth the watch. And George has produced several other wonderful sports documentaries in the years since, including one on the Miracle on Ice 1980 U.S. Olympic hockey team, and one on Mickey Mantle. You know how much I love my movie tie-ins. So, get ready for next week, a very special 30 with Murdy built around the upcoming Field of Dreams game, which is coming on August 12th, featuring the Yankees and White Sox. I think you're going to like this one, so stay tuned. Better yet, subscribe now, and you'll get it delivered when it's up next week. So until then, like I said, hit subscribe and review and all that jazz. And until next time, I'm Sweeney Murdy. Thanks for listening.
You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.